And peace with best penetrating and perfect Dharma is rightly met with being in 100,000 million kalpas, having it to see and listen to remember and accept. I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning.
Good morning.
What a beautiful place to practice. Isn't it Leonard Cohen's song, something about the, and Suzanne, something about the sun pouring in like honey or something like that? I felt that this morning. So I try to pull together a few thoughts about Sesshin. As we come in and do kind of intensive retreat, and I might not get to all of them, but hopefully I'll get to some kind of what could encourage us and kind of help us approach the rest of today and tomorrow and as we go forth into the world. So I wanted to start off with a couple of Zen koans. And Zen koans are incidents, teaching examples that have been passed down to us. Somehow people, when they observed practice in the community, exchanges between people, there were certain incidents that particularly sayings that particularly inspired them, and they were recorded. Often not encouraged by the teacher. Sometimes the teacher actually says, I don't want you to write anything down. In fact, there's even one story where somebody came in and actually dressed in a paper robe so they could take notes on their sleeves so they could take it and share it with future generations. But there is something of great value in many of these koans. So here, this is one from Yangguan, 750 to 842. Lived a long and industrious life. He was a student of Matsu. Matsu was one of the great giants of kind of early Zen, literally a giant. He said he was close to 7 feet tall. And Yangguan, his disciple, was clearly in his lineage. And what's interesting about Yangguan is he actually started off, his interest was more in the Vinaya, studying the Vinaya. And that the Vinaya is the study of the precepts. So the idea being is the more you can regulate your conduct, the more rules you can follow, the more precise you can be in terms of your deportment, that's going to lead you to awakening. And at some point, he began to see the limitation of that. Because although Zen, as you learn in creating the forms of the Zen to one-arm practice, does have rules of deportment, but they're not the most important thing. The most important thing is for us to liberate our minds. And then from a liberated mind, the precepts flow more naturally. So he started to study Zen. So here's two koans. The first one's a little short, and it's going to lead me to the second one. So the first one is, a disciple comes up and says, the question he presents to him is, what is the body of Vairochana Buddha? What is the body of Vairochana Buddha? So Vairochana Buddha is the name, or the best we can come up with, the label for what the absolute Buddha is. It would be kind of like, in the Christian tradition, it would be like God. God would be Vairochana Buddha, the absolute. You know, maybe Jesus would be like Shakyamuni Buddha, sort of the emanation of God on earth, right? Vairochana is like the absolute, best thing we can come up with. So he's saying, what is the body? I mean, doesn't even, what is the, if Vairochana doesn't really have a body, Shakyamuni had a body, what's the body of Vairochana? So Yangguan, without hesitation, you know, probably picks up his fan or his staff, and he points over there and he says, bring me that clear pitcher of water. And the disciple gets the pitcher, he brings it back, and he says, okay, now return it. He returns the pitcher of water. He comes back, and he says, I don't know what that's all about. But he asks the question again. What's the body of Vairochana Buddha? And Yangguan sees that he doesn't get it. And he says, the ancient Buddhas are long gone. Hmm. The Buddha you're looking for, outside this immediate moment, is long gone. It's right here. So the way you'd work with that koan would be a clear pitcher of water. You could sit. What am I like a clear pitcher of water? What is my mind like a clear pitcher of water? So he's giving you a visual image, a tactile experience, not an intellectual understanding of Vairochana's body, because clearly Vairochana's body is the pitcher of water. You know, he could have pointed to anything in the room, probably. But the metaphor of the clear water is very beautiful. But this leads me to the koan I want to discuss in a little more depth. This is one I worked with in my group, I think it was last year. So he's taking the seat, he's preparing for a ceremony, and he says to his attendant, go get me the rhinoceros fan. So the fan is just one of the little accoutrements, like the staff that the teacher has for, like, you don't even really open it, you just kind of hold it. You know, it's kind of a symbol of sort of a feminine quality, actually, is one reason. Mightiest kind of a fan. Yeah. Says, get me the rhinoceros fan. You know, that was when we didn't have to worry too much about how many rhinoceroses there were around back in the 9th century. And the attendant says, because he's really on top of it, he knows what's happening, he says, the rhinoceros fan is broken. And without hesitation, Yang Guan says, bring me the rhinoceros. The attendant was struck dumb. A little like maybe I said to Bob, Bob, bring me the bell. And you said, the bell's broken. And I said, well, bring me the sound. Not quite the same effect as a rhinoceros, but you're getting the feeling. So the reason I'm telling you this is because I want to give you some idea about what koans and what practice can do. That's a little different than the way we normally think about things. First thing that happens when the attendant was struck dumb, a space opened. There was a gap. He didn't know. He was stalled. The fixing mind went into abeyance, and there was a gap for something else to happen. Usually, the way we approach life is we want to add something. We want to improve it. We want to polish it, and we want to gain something, right? We want to fix it. But actually, what practice is about is more about letting go, about throwing things away. It's about uncovering something that was of value that's always present. The other day when I was preparing for this lecture a little bit, I was sitting having a cup of tea in my living room, and I looked over and the sunlight was kind of beaming in. I'm sure you've all had moments like this. And there was a broom standing up against the wall. And the light was hitting it, and it was a broom that I used to sweep up dirt. But I bought it at a craft fair a number of years ago, and it has a natural handle with bark still on it, and the bristles are particularly elegant, but I normally never notice it. But there was something about that moment and the stillness and the light with the broom standing that was extraordinarily eloquent. So this is a little bit about what our practice can help us with. We sit long hours, often kind of boring. We struggle with our discomfort. And it's hard for us to see where the gap is. It just seems like a continual stream of thoughts. But I'm encouraging you to trust the process, to really see that something's cooking. Something's cooking. It said in that particular koan that even though the attendant was struck dumb because maybe he was put so much on the spot, there was another attendant that quickly picked up a piece of paper, drew a circle, and drew a picture of a rhinoceros inside the circle. So that's pretty good. That's pretty good. You know. So what Koans and Sesshins try to get you to do, instead of trying to improve your mind or control your mind, they're trying to get you to make friends with the unpredictable nature of your mind. Meditation and Sesshins are actually more of an art form than a science. And if you think about it that way, I think you'll enjoy it more. You can kind of enjoy the craziness of the process and have a sense of humor about it rather than a sense of failure about it. I gave a lecture last week in my group up that we're studying the Diamond Sutra. And what we learned in the Diamond Sutra, as sort of an introductory lecture to the whole Prajnaparamita and certainly the Heart Sutra, is it, as Koans and Sesshins do, encourage you to make kind of a quantum leap, to think outside the box. That's what the rhinoceros is encouraging you to do. You know, Aristotelian logic says A is A, B is B. Because that's true, A cannot be B. Well, when we chanted the Heart Sutra this morning, did you get that is totally what they're not saying? They're saying no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. Well, of course, A, B, C, and D are A, B, C, and D. But they're saying they're much more than that. A is B, and A is C, and A is D. That's what the Heart Sutra is saying. That's what the Diamond Sutra is saying. That's what these koans are trying to get you to see. That it doesn't progress 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Often that's the way meditation techniques are presented. In our tradition, and the way we look at it, it's more like 1, 2, 3, 40. And so you open yourself to the 40, or the 50, or the 220,000. That's what this process is opening us to. There was a nice quote that I liked. Sesshins, meditation, koans can open you to a happiness that comes for no good reason. They open you to a happiness that existed before there were reasons for happiness. It takes courage. What it's encouraging you to do is to think about yourself. The change is to think about yourself in a different way. Not so much to improve yourself, but to think about yourself in a different way. In the wheel, in the Dharma wheel, as you work around at about 9 o'clock, there's a symbol which I often use called the house. And so the more we paint the house and spiff up the house and shine the windows and maybe put some blinds on to keep the too much sunlight out or control the wind, control the environment, arrange the furniture just right, that's not what we're trying to do in practice. What we're trying to do is tear the walls down. That's fundamentally what we're trying to do here, is tear down the walls of how we look at ourselves. Let's go back to the koan for a minute. So the attendant says, the rhinoceros fan is broken. So maybe what he was really saying was, I'm broken. Because aren't we all? Doesn't everybody here know that they're broken? How incredibly imperfect we all are. Right? So maybe what he was saying is, I'm broken, I'm hurting, I need help. Help me. And the way Yang An responded was outside the box. He didn't say, well, if you do this, if you practice the precepts, and you do this practice, and you sit diligently every day, and you get rid of all these thoughts that are not very helpful thoughts for you to have, and you do this sequentially, you're going to feel better. And that's true. That's true. But Yang An was looking at the big picture. That's what Zen teachers try to do. And he said what he saw was Buddha. He saw his wholeness. He saw his brokenness, but he saw his wholeness. And he was encouraging him to move towards his wholeness. And that's what Buddhas do. Just like you as a good parent, when you're not pushed against the wall too hard, your child comes in pain and anguish, acting as they're supposed to do and be, childish, and you respond with a sense of humor. And what you see is who they are, you know, and what their potential is. So that's what Yangguan was doing. And isn't that what all koans do in some ways? Almost every koan that I see, the teacher comes and says, give me the teaching. You know, if they're a little bit humble, which I think is better, they come and say, I'm broken. I am hurting. Unfortunately, Zen koans don't emphasize that language, which I think is really unfortunate. They usually emphasize more the arrogant side. I want the knowledge. I want the intelligence, how to figure this out. And the teacher cuts the rug out from under them. You know, if they're probably one of the real arrogant types, he'll say something like, Joshu, well, did you have lunch? Well, just go wash the dish. Go wash your dishes. That's where you're going to find the body of Vairochana Buddha, is in washing the dishes. Mm. Or maybe he'll pick up a lamp you're holding and it'll blow the candle out. Can you just let go of the idea that you have for right now about how broken you are? You can let go of that for today, for this period, maybe for just 10 seconds in a half an hour period, you can just let go of your thought of how broken you are and create some gap, some space for the rhinoceros to come in. So I think all koans are doing this, encouraging us to take the quantum leap. And very much when the attendant was struck dumb, there was a gap. So what we're encouraged is not to learn and to gain and even to understand. What we're encouraged to do is to doubt in a very fundamental and soft and compassionate way. We call that great doubt. It goes something like this, well, that could be true, but what else? I don't know the answer. I'll never know the answer. I'm open to more information. I'm open to learning more about this. And that's what koans do. Bring me the rhinoceros. What? There's no intellectual answer to how to bring the rhinoceros in the room, right? But you can keep wondering, how could I? What is the rhinoceros? How could I bring something like a rhinoceros more in the room? And you keep wondering, and you turn. And that's how you work with a koan. Or how you work with a koan of how your mind works, moment to moment. I went in to get my phone wasn't working anymore. I'm kind of a low-tech kind of guy, but I went into the computer store. And I just remembered a story I read. Ed Brown went in to get a... You know who Ed Brown is? He's like a Zen teacher, you know, wrote Tassar. He went to a computer store, and he talks to this guy, and he's totally overwhelmed by these guys. You know, all these young energy, and they're talking all this high-tech stuff. And he says to the sales... the saleswoman comes up, and she says, how you doing? He says, I'm feeling overwhelmed. And she says to him, well, you should try meditation. And Ed goes, he's cool. He goes, oh. First thing he goes, Jesus, in 45 years I've been meditating and it doesn't show. And then she says, he says, well, do you meditate? And she says, oh, yeah, I've been meditating for 3 years. It's fantastic. It's just totally changed my life. And Ed's just going like, just feel like it kind of has to work with a failure part. So anyway, so I went into a computer store, and it was true. There are all these 28-year-old guys and a few women, but mostly guys, just the competition there was so thick about how smart you were and how on top you were of every single button and every little nuance. And it was just how they talked to each other. There was no sense of social skills. They were just like one intellectual one-upmanship after the next. I had to kind of smile. It was also very helpful. They got to kind of understand as best as my brain could understand these things. You know, why this one may be better than that one, but he completely couldn't understand why I didn't want to pay the extra $10 for texting. I didn't want to tell him that I don't text, you know. I barely could make the phone call and, okay, send the email out. That's going to be fine. I don't need to text. He says, but what do you mean you're not? What do you mean you don't text?
While you drive.
So, anyway. Okay. So that's about cones and setting. Now I'm going to do a little shift here. I need to actually take my watch off so I can see what time we are. Mm-hmm. Okay. How do you bring the rhinoceros into the room? So this morning we read the Fugon Zazengi. The Fugon Zazengi is an instruction manual about how to bring the rhinoceros into the room. And again, many meditation techniques in the Buddhist tradition will emphasize a sequential path, or they'll emphasize how we can control our minds, or how we can organize it in a way that's more tolerable. But Dogen, and not just Dogen, but in our particular branch, and also even in the Zen school, like in the Rinzai school, the very strong emphasis in Kensho experiences. You know, these flashes of light, insight, everything drops away, and you really have a sense of experiencing the luminosity. Our way is, I don't know, so sweet and beautiful and accessible. Ours is about sitting as a ritual enactment. I want you to think about this. You're sitting as a ritual enactment of realization. That's what this whole thing is about. That's what Fukan Zazengi is about. And that can be, if ritual scares you a little bit, maybe that puts you off a little bit. I hope it doesn't. I hope you see the power of ritual. Mm-hmm. Let me just help you with this a little bit. When you think about, this is not something foreign and esoteric, you know. It's in our everyday life. When you're thinking about, like, Thanksgiving, what happens in Thanksgiving? If you sit there and read about the story of the first Thanksgiving, it'll stimulate a little something, right, if you get it intellectually. But if you clean the house, and you send out the invitations, and you buy the food, and you do this with the right mind, right, not like a regret, how come nobody's helping me mind, but it more like, I'm going to try to... This is going to be a joyful occasion. And you invite people. You know, if you're smart, you make it a potluck, and other people are home cooking, or some people... And the whole thing comes together, and you do a little grace, and you really get into this sense of a wonderful thing that we're all doing this thing together. What happens? The whole process transforms your state of mind, right? The act of cooking and eating is transformative. That's what a ritual is. And that's what meditation is. If you sit, it's an enactment of what's happening. So a couple of quotes. It's seen as a ritual enactment, an expression of awakened awareness. In this approach, practice is a ritual expression whose transformative qualities is not based on stages of attainment or meditative prowess. So in the Fukan Zazengi, when we go through, I'll pick out a few phrases for you just to go back to emphasize that I was paying attention. You don't have to, I'll read it to you. The first paragraph, it says, the way is originally perfect and all-prevailing. The rhinoceros is here. It's already the clear pitcher of water. But we do need to practice, you know. The sages in the past had to realize this, and so do we. So then he says, put aside intellectual practice of investigating words. Drop the words. Stop chasing phrases. Stop getting hooked into your stories and beliefs that come up again and again. Stop. Try to stop. Try to stop that. Take the backward step, as Chris was saying. Not the forward step, which our society and our culture and all our education, gaining more, it's out there, accumulation. Take the backward step, to the underlying happiness and goodness, which is there, if you can just uncover it and give it some space. Take the backward step. Go back to where you, what you have. Go home. Go home. And then he goes ahead and gives you all the ways to do the ritual. Have a nice place, you know. The whole thing is set up to help you in this ritual enactment. We have a beautiful room. We have a little Buddha that just kind of helps you remind you of what you're like. So when we bow, we're really bowing to our own sense of enlightenment. We bow when we come in. We bow to the cushion. We bow to everybody in the room. So we're creating an atmosphere of where we can sit down and really be present. Not trying to gain anything. Not necessarily trying to improve anything. Just to be present. To make friends with whatever presents itself. This being the case, intellect or lack of it is not an issue. It doesn't care how smart you are. It doesn't have anything to do with it. Just your ability to be present. Makes no distinction between dull and sharp-witted. If you concentrate your effort single-mindedly, that in itself is wholeheartedly engaging away. Practice realization is naturally undefiled. Going forward is, after all, an everyday affair. So, the trap, though, is, and he says earlier, he says, how do you do this? Drop your intellectual chasing after thoughts. Think beyond thinking. He says think non-thinking, but I like the translation. Think beyond thinking. So he's not saying try to control it, eliminate thoughts. He's saying think beyond your thoughts. But there's a little bit of a trap here. Thoughts are, as I was saying last night, thoughts are so seductive. They grab us. I want to really encourage you to develop the capacity of concentration today, for the rest of today and tonight. Really try to concentrate, because he says it really does take effort. You know, don't just sit there and think, I'm sitting in this posture, thoughts are coming through, it's just what they are, and I'll just, and there's a little bit of a temptation to want to indulge them, so you'll start to indulge them. It helps the time go by. The period will go by quicker, right? You can even catch it after a while. Most of the time you don't catch it, but sometimes you can catch it where it goes, there, no, I don't want to give it up. I need to figure this out. If I do stay with this, it'll be good for my practice, because I'll figure it out. You know, intellectually, I'll come to a conclusion. It's not what we're doing here. We're really practicing gently, as often as we can, dropping the thought. Try to give up some expectation. So on one hand, you're very idealistic. You're trying to bring the rhinoceros into the room. Your intention, hopefully, is firm and committed. You have some enthusiasm for the practice. You realize that hundreds of thousands of people have really practiced this practice. In the same way, we're in a very deep lineage. The people that we're following. We have a lot of support to do this. You're in the stream, the current, hundreds of thousands of people that have really done this practice. Have some enthusiasm. Kind of trust the process. Ultimately, you're the one that has to decide whether it works or not, you know, for you. It's the right practice. But trust it for a while. On the other hand, don't be too idealistic. because nobody is particularly good at this. This is humbling, to sit with your mind on this cushion. It makes you, what it's not trying to get you to be is discouraged. It's trying to get you to appreciate your humanness and the human condition. You know, so even really, if you try and you feel, maybe you only catch 5 or 6 thoughts during a half an hour period, and you're able to drop them. That's okay. You know, it's the process of effort, of trying, of coming back, of distilling. That's what we're looking for. And it's a very physical practice. It's not about thinking your way to Vairochana Buddha. It's about sitting down, feeling the ground, like Shakyamuni, touching the ground, touching the body, touching the physical sensations of the earth under you, touching the physical sensations that are coursing through your body. That's very much a part of the practice. It's not separate. You know, it's not like heaven is out there and this is the mundane world down here. This is the world down here. This present moment. So give up the expectation also of trying to have a perfect practice place, of creating a perfect little house that's going to be totally supportive. We do the best we can, you know. But if you can remember a couple of sessions ago, there were a bunch of guys about 2 miles down the road that were practicing their AK-47s. And we had to sit through a couple of periods of target practice. And we didn't know if it was going to go on all day or not. You know, I went over, very naively, over to Brian and said, can you just go down and tell him to stop? He looked at me like, are you nuts? You know, he says, we have to live with it. We don't know when it's going to happen. And it may happen later this afternoon. We don't know. So, yes, you don't want to deliberately put yourself in a place where you are disturbed. You know, it says in the Visuddhimagga, don't sit near the ocean. Don't sit near public places because you need a place that's more quiet. On the other hand, it's never going to be perfect. Part of what will happen in Sesshin is because you're more sensitive, things will definitely occur to you that will be disturbing. So your practice is to give up your preferences. Not completely, but try to give up a few of your preferences. Now, if you're the kind of person that always gives up their preferences for somebody else's preference, well, then maybe you have to give up that preference. You know, so it's a little tricky how you look at that. But usually, just think, is this an opportunity for me to just let go a little bit of the way I need to have it to be perfectly safe and comfortable? Because that's what practice is. It's about not being able to structure your reality. It's about taking things as they come, including your mind states, right? We don't fight them. We learn to be with them and make friends with them. So it's okay not to do it well, right? Because all of us aren't doing it particularly well. Humility helps. A sense of humility. When we do this practice, we don't do it out of a sense of, you know, arrogance, or we're going to make ourselves better, or there's a little bit of a tendency to maybe want to show off by doing things a little more slowly or precisely. Deportment is very important in our practice because it's not just what happens on the cushion. We are ritually enacting on the cushion what Buddha did. We're sitting like Buddha sat, alert, with energy, present, accepting, and compassion. We're trying to ritually enact that moment as best we can, moment to moment. And then we try to do that throughout the rest of our day. And that's what's nice about working together in this session. We're intimately connected. We go in and we wash dishes together. So this sense of deportment, how we carry ourselves, you could think of everything as a ritual enactment of enlightenment. How you cut a carrot. How would the Buddha cut a carrot? Well, he would cut it maybe so precisely and so slowly, but then you'd look at him and you'd go, there's something a little off. It's a little too ostentatious. So, you know, that's why Dogen says, don't have any designs on being the Buddha. Don't have the self-conscious. See if you can let go of that. Do it simply and beautifully and non-ostentatiously. Don't try to call attention to yourself. You might even deliberately try to make a mistake every now and then, just to make other people feel better. You know, that could be a practice, actually, for you, for some people, right? Compassion. So we practice with the heart of bodhicitta. We practice with a sense of both way-seeking mind, seeking awakeness, to try to be awake. And we do it because we're helping other people. We're doing it not only because if we wake up and we can have more of a sense of appreciation and gentleness and kindness, we really know that that's what it takes to raise our children right, to be with our partners, and to be with difficult people around us. It will help them. The more centered and the more balanced. And you all know that. That's why you're here. That's why you're working on yourself. So you can help others. And particularly compassion, of course, to whatever the moment presents itself. Even the painful moments and the difficult moments. A sense of softness and non-judgmentalness. And just returning again and again to letting it go. Letting it go. Letting it go. Creating room for the rhinoceros and the vase of pure water.
May our intentions equally penetrate every being.